I finished fifth in my sword form, and I finished eighth in my bare hand form, which to me was soul crushing. which is a weird thing, you know, when you reach that type of level of competition, basically any position is a win. I train basically 15 hours a week for 15 months, at the highest levels to go there and compete. And that type of training takes a toll on you. So going back to the whole Simone Biles thing, one of the things I noticed was seeing that face, seeing something off, and having been in that high pressure position and then failing, it's not a failure by no means, fifth in the world is not a failure, but you can, pressure comes from both the outside and the inside when it comes to sports, especially for people who have to deal with mental illness, like I do. So, by applying too much pressure to yourself, regardless of your finish, you can even win and still be disappointed. So it's a really, really careful line you have to thread when you push yourself in athletics and you're dealing with things like anxiety and depression.
You're listening to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast. And this is Trail Talk, where we have casual conversations with all kinds of runners. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultra runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation will go. So if you're ready, let's get started. Hey, welcome to the show, the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast. My guest today is Tony Diaz, and I hope you got your name right, Tony.
You got it.
Okay. He is a cyclist and a wushu wushu practitioner or a wushu yep. martial artist?
Yeah,
wushu practitioner. Okay. And also a runner. I've known him and his wife. I've actually known him through his wife for several years. I've kind of followed each other on Facebook, and so wanted to have him on the show and talk about kind of whatever comes up. Welcome to the show, Tony.
Thank you for having me.
So usually what I start out with is asking people, have you asked, tell a little bit about yourself and how is it that you became involved in athletics? I know, you do more than running, so I'll just kind of say athletics. What was your kind of? And I see behind you. I mean, if people who are seeing this we don't have video on the podcast, but you've got a shelf full of medals back behind you. So
one or two
medals and trophies. So I assume you have a lot of athletic stories. So
quite a few. I've always been athletic. And I come from a very athletic family. They've always competed in running, handball, just you name the sport, they loved it. And then I've been doing martial arts for over 20 years easily. And I've been running. I used to run in high school and in junior high. And then I started into cycling when I was in college for a little bit, mostly just to get here and there. I went to UC Santa Barbara, and that's a very cycling oriented school. Mm-hmm. In fact, the cyclists on campus have right of way. If you are in the path and they run you over, it's your fault. so that's kind of fun. I didn't really get into cycling and competitive cycling, I should say, until I moved out here to Oklahoma, where I met a couple of locals and some teams. And I've been racing for about 10 years or so. So that's okay. The long and short of it.
Yeah. And you race, I think you race on the road as well as you do cyclocross.
Correct. I do. Yeah.
I'm watching your Facebook. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a Cat 4 road racer. Don't really have aspirations to go much higher than that. I am still a beginner cross racer only because I love it. Cross is a great discipline. It incorporates a lot of the cardio, a lot of the biking aspect, but also a lot of that running aspect that we do too, getting off mm-hmm. the bike and having to know how to manage your body and your movement. So I really do enjoy that. And, I enjoy doing it more than competing in it. Yeah, that's why I'm probably not going to upgrade and get really competitive, but the courses are a blast. It's like being a kid again, where you just took your little 10 speed bike and rode it anywhere you wanted.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Cause cyclocross is kind of a version of motor. I mean, like motocross with bicycle.
Not the motor.
without the motor. Cause you're racing. I mean, you're riding on. Now, do all courses have a little bit of asphalt as well? I mean, I know some courses will have
The majority of
asphalt and grass.
The majority of them start off on an asphalt path. And then in almost all cases, they go into a really sharp, tight turn. And that's the entry. It's also called the hole shot. It's kind of how you control the race. If you can get to that point first and not crash, then you typically have a better chance of maintaining a good position. So every course tends to have, you know, about maybe 100 yards of pavement, and then the rest of the course will be gravel, mud, grass, even mountainy type single track terrain. It runs the gamut. Of course, then you also have all the obstacles they put in your way. They, you know, you have to dismount your bike and jump over barricades or climb up really steep hills that there's just, you know, in talking like 40% grades, things you cannot. Absolutely, there's no way to ride up these things. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a blast.
Yeah, and the cyclocross races, I've always seen seen videos. They've always just shown a little bit of grass. I didn't realize they did on single track and that kind of those kind of extreme thing. The ones I saw were looked like they were difficult, but weren't quite that extreme.
Yeah, it's pretty big. In fact, we're having Worlds in Fayetteville in 2022. So that's actually a really big deal. But in the US, it's getting bigger. But if you go over to Europe and watch those competitions, you'll have 10,000 spectators watching the course. It is massive out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean, it's similar to road cycling. I mean, it seems that, the Tour de France draws, people. I mean, when you watch that, there are people standing out in the middle of nowhere lining the mountain roads. And I've always thought that would be kind of fun to do. And then I thought, wow, you stand there for hours and hours just to watch, a few minutes of them.
Of them riding by and you're done.
Yeah. So you said you're a Cat 4 road racer. What does, somebody who doesn't know road racing, what does that mean?
So there are five categories of road racer. Novice used to be called Cat 5. Now it's called novice. And everyone begins as a Cat 5 or novice on road. And the different disciplines have different categories. So mountain bike has three different categories. Cross and road have five different categories. And when you're a novice, you can basically stay a novice as long as you want. There's no requirement to upgrade. However, you can upgrade to a Cat 4, your next level up, after 10 races. Doesn't mean you have to finish those races at any particular position. You just have to finish the race.
Okay.
And Cat 4 is pretty much the journeyman level. You're a Cat 4 for life. You can never go down to a Cat 5.
Okay.
Once you're a Cat 4, you're a Cat 4 for life. And then beyond Cat 4, you need to start winning races. Depending on the type, the size of the race, the type of the race, the type of the competition that you have and your finishing position will earn you points. The more points you earn, those can be used to upgrade to the next level. And then it gets harder and harder as you go up to eventually the 1-2 levels, which are basically considered professional without actually being paid. And then you have the pro level, which is where you're paid.
Okay. So there's a lot involved in that thing. So,
there really is.
Yeah. And it's like there's point systems in, you were talking about point systems. The thing I thought about was NASCAR, and I'm not a NASCAR fan.
Yeah.
And so, I kind of look at the, from the outside and go, okay, it's one of those things. It's like the people who are fans know it. And but it's that kind of idea is that you've got points. You don't necessarily have to come in and as a winner of the race, you just
right
your points are worth.
Yeah, so if you finish typically on most races, if you finish within the top 5 to 10 positions, you're going to earn some points, and then as long as you accrue enough within a year, you can upgrade. And again, anything above Cat 4, if let's say for example you're a Cat 3 or a Cat 2 and you take a year or two off, you can request a downgrade to go back down because your fitness can drop off and so on. You can go back down, but you can only go to a 4, no lower.
So where do you guys, where do you race? I mean, are you now, cause when I am familiar, you know, my experience with road racing is Tour de France, right. You know, and there's always teams. I mean, are you racing on a team? Is that?
I am. I started out with the Tulsa Wheelmen, way back in, I think 2012, 2013. And I raced with them for several years. And then I raced with Bixby Bicycles while they had a team over, again, this is in the Tulsa region of Oklahoma. And then now I am on the Team Air Assurance. But honestly, I work with everyone. It's, you know, Tulsa is a little big city. I'm originally from Brooklyn. So I'm used to big cities.
Yeah, that's a big city, yeah.
Yeah. So for me, it's the population is too small to really almost justify as many teams as we have. We have a lot of little race teams, and we all ride group rides together. Then when we get out there and we do a race, all of a sudden everyone's everyone's not friendly anymore. So when it comes to outside of the races, I sometimes. When I have time, I've been traveling a lot lately, but I'll put on criterium clinics where I'll teach, beginners the basics. And I'm by no means an expert. I don't claim to be an expert. But the only thing I can say is I'm a decent bike handler and I've, survived every race, including some really near close call crashes. So because of that, I teach people how to be safe in races and how to learn to enjoy the race. Not necessarily, you're not going to learn how to win from me per se, but you will learn how to survive. And to me, that's, that's 9/10 of it. If you can finish a race, that's a good start.
Yeah. So, tell me a little bit more about Wushu. You went to, you went overseas. I remember seeing your trip that you went overseas for a competition.
I did.
So it's like, it's not like you're a novice there either.
No, I'm a... Yeah.
So what is your Marshall? I mean, because you kind of have on Facebook anyway, you call yourself the Marshall cyclist.
Marshall cyclist. Yep.
those are kind of your wheelhouse, I think. So
pretty much.
So what, tell us about Wushu.
So Wushu literally in Chinese, it basically means martial art. That's actually exactly what it translates to. Mm-hmm. Basically what it encompasses is all Chinese martial arts. Now, Chinese martial arts is huge. It's been going for thousands of years. There are literally hundreds of different disciplines. To say Wushu is kind of like anyone else saying I'm a martial artist, but not saying exactly what their art is. Because there are so many different divisions of arts in Chinese martial arts. So when people hear the term Kung Fu, right? They're very familiar with that word. Kung Fu is an Americanization of the word Gong Fu. And so they heard this term back when Chinese films were getting popular, right? With the Bruce Lees and so on coming over from the Hong Kong movie studios. And they didn't realize that the term Gong Fu actually means learned skill. They just thought, oh, it's Kung Fu, it's martial art. Really, you have Gong Fu, a learned skill in Wushu. So you can be a painter and have Gong Fu. You can be a runner like you are, and especially doing the ultra distances you do, you would have Gong Fu. It's a learned skill, something that you practice day in and day out and become proficient in. So that term kind of got used in America synonymously and converted into the word Kung Fu to mean martial arts.
A style of martial art, yeah.
Right, exactly. I have won several national titles. I've written a book on the lineage of several martial arts in Kung Fu, in Wushu. And in 2016, I qualified for the US World Traditional Team, along with my Siga, my teacher brother, my older teacher. And we had a team of four of us that traveled to China and competed at Worlds in 2017.
Okay, that is interesting, and I'm sure there's a lot more involved. I'm sure you gave us just the condensed
version of that.
So describe. I mean, your competition. I remember it was a form competition as well as sparring, or
so. Yes,
I've seen you with the sword, and you look really cool.
Well, thank you. I only do forms now. I used to spar when I was younger, but after many, many injuries and enough concussions, I'm kind of done. I still practice self-defense and in that aspect of martial arts, but I typically don't spar very much anymore. However, the world's competition was for forms, both weapons and bare hand. I finished fifth in my sword form, and I finished eighth in my bare hand form, which to me was soul crushing. which is a weird thing, you know, when you reach that type of level of competition, you know, basically any position is a win. You know, it takes, I train basically 15 hours a week for 14, 15 months, you know, at the highest levels to go there and compete. And that type of training takes a toll on you. So going back to the whole Simone Biles thing, you know, one of the things I noticed was seeing that face, seeing something off, on a, you know, and having been in that high pressure position and then failing, I kind of, well, for me failing, and it's not a failure by no means, you know, fifth in the world's not a failure. But you can, you know, pressure comes from both the outside and the inside when it comes to sports, especially for people who have to deal with mental illness, like I do. So, by applying too much pressure to yourself, regardless of your finish, you can even win and still be disappointed. So it's a really, really careful line you have to thread when you push yourself in athletics and you're dealing with things like anxiety and depression.
And you said you saw something on her face that you realized she was in trouble with before she even said anything.
So during her warmups, on one of the teams, I was watching her perform some of the practices. You know, they have these cameras all over the athletes.
Oh yes,
which is just infuriating to me, knowing, you know, like how, you know, being you want to concentrate, you want to do well, and you have to deal with, you know, part of it is dealing with the media. They're gonna be there. But you know, I just saw that look. She had done one pass, she comes off the floor, and it was a practice pass, but there's something in her look that told me it's not right. There's something off. And the reason why is because I've seen that look. I've made that look. I'll have days where I'm training and all of a sudden my form feels like an unfolding lawn chair, you know, like you can never get it right. But it wasn't just, you know, every now and then I bet you have a run, and you feel like, you know what, you just don't have it today. Right.
That happens more often than I would like.
Right. And it does happen. And then there's the time where even when you know you have it, you know, your body is set, you're ready to go, your mind isn't there. And the expression on those two are different. I've had days where, you know, I know my body's exhausted and I go out on a run. I just did a 4-mile run up in Denver the other day and my body was just beat. I couldn't do it. I'm like, okay, this is not happening, right? But my mind was in a good place, so I didn't have the same type of exhaustion. Whereas when my mind's not in a good place, even it doesn't matter how well my body is feeling, you know, my expressions, my emotions, the way I respond to competition just is different. And I saw that in how she, you know, because leading up to her performance in the Olympics, all you hear is greatest of all time. And, you know, it's a big thing in American culture to build up heroes. We love doing this. It's, you know, it's part of it is an aspirational thing, right? We like to build them up so we can say, we can do that, right? This is a normal person, but we can do that. But really, it's not a normal person, right? It takes someone beyond to make it to the Olympics. It takes someone dedicated enough to train and to give up a large portion of their life to do something like that. I mean, when I train for Worlds, again, that's not nearly the level of the Olympics. You know, it's not giving up my life.
Right. But you had a taste of, that. I'm sure there are a lot of things you made sacrifices to do
for sure.
that level of training.
Exactly. You know, and so, you know, I got a taste of what that's like. And at that point I can no longer say I'm just a normal athlete training and competing around because I'm giving up a good portion of a year and a half of my life to train up for this one competition. And, you know, when I did that competition, I was already 38, which was pretty interesting because the age range of that competition for my group was 18 to 39. So I was a whole person in their prime older than my youngest competition. literally, the youngest person in there was 19 in my group. Right. So that was that kind of put me on the on the hard end of things. Mm-hmm. But it also gives me a little more perspective, a little more ability to deal with these things and deal with the mental pressures, because I've kind of, you know, I have the life experience of dealing, a longer experience of dealing with the mental issues I've had to deal with most of my life. Mm-hmm. These younger athletes, you know, Simone Biles is what, 24 now, I think. And you know, that's very young. There's a long, I mean, that's not even a quarter into the lifespan now nowadays.
Right.
So it's scary to think about the amount of pressure that not only she can put on herself, but that others are putting on her on behalf of themselves. You know, they want to achieve through her. And that's, well, scares me.
That's kind of what we do with Olympic athletes. I mean, they're representing us as a nation. I mean, they're supposed to be, you know, the best of us. And so we put them there and we have that identity because, you know, they're, you know, it's part of our national, who we are.
Right. And we see it all the time. You know, someone could be training in Denver, but they were born in New York and they went to school in California, and every, you know, Colorado, New York, and California will all claim that they're from that state.
Yeah. And people tend to, I mean, I think that identification with something other than ourselves is normal. I mean, people do that with sports teams.
And that's exactly what I was going to bring up. Yeah.
And it's, you know, it does, for some reason, I don't have that switch in me because
it's not a bad thing.
because you know, my wife, she says, well, how come you don't get excited about, you know, watching these games? And I'm like, well, I clap when they do well, you know, and she's wanting more emotional attachment. And I was like, no, it doesn't do it for me. But I know I have friends who do. I mean, like,
right,
when they're watching football, their emotional state is totally, you know, totally fed off that game. And so, you know, they go to the high of heights, lows of lows, and so it's just this up and down. And I'm just sitting there going, not me.
I'm sorry, I was going to say this. Listen to their vernacular. Especially people who are fans of teams, but not the super fans. Super fans, you know, diehards. I have a cousin, he's a Jets fan. Doesn't matter whether they do good or bad, he is a Jets fan. That's it. But people who aren't the fans to that level, people who like the sport, but not necessarily, you know, are true super fans, they'll say, my team won, or they lost. And that I always found very interesting, how we create a dichotomy in our aspirations, right? When they're winning, we want to win too. Now I'm a part of that team. When they lose, it's they lost, not we lost.
Yeah.
So I had no part of that. You know, I didn't make the call on the field. I didn't drop that that ball when it was fumbled.
Right. But that is so. I mean, we tend to do that same with Olympic athletes and, you know, any sport we identify with, but the Olympics, there's, I think, more pressure on Olympic athletes because it's not like they're representing a town and it's not, you know, they've got that added pressure. So, I didn't studied Simone Biles. Has she kind of dealt with the kind of mental anxiety in the past? I haven't heard.
So she has, it came out, I want to say it was, a couple of years ago, where she did finally admit that she was abused, during the whole Nasser case. She was one of the ones that was abused, and she told her family, and her family saw that something was wrong. But they couldn't put their finger on it. Obviously she couldn't bring herself to, you know, say what happened, and that's really difficult. So having to compete at the top level, right, while carrying that mental and physical abuse, and not knowing how to verbalize it, not knowing how to share and get it out there. I mean, that just compounds the issues. So, and this is not a problem just with, you know, with Ms. Biles. It's actually a problem with a lot of top level athletes who have dealt with not only, let's say, depression, anxiety, all sorts of other mental issues, but it's also that these athletes are, I kind of lost where I was going there. I have a point.
Okay. That's fine.
It's they see when you're training, right? Part of when you're training, especially when you want to get competitive to a really high level, is learning how to identify weakness in yourself, learning how to identify what's missing, right?
Okay.
And either compartmentalizing it or working around it, figuring out a solution. So when it comes to the mental aspect of sports, a lot of the time dealing with other mental issues, mental illnesses, athletes will often say, well, this is a part of me that's not working. I need to push that aside and hide that so I can deal with the parts that do work.
Okay.
And I used to do this myself before I was finally diagnosed with manic depression. And I just thought, well, something's wrong, but I don't know what it is and I can't deal with it. I need to get better. And that made it worse because, as you get better with sports and any athletic endeavor, that pressure will build, if you don't address
it. And pushing it aside. So what you're saying is that in the physical, that if there's an area of weakness, athletes will work around it. And so they do the same thing. They do the same thing mentally. And the way they work around it is to compartmentalize it, put it off the side and ignore it.
Right.
That's not just athletes. I mean, I think that's a tendency that we all do.
For sure.
I don't want to deal with this right now.
And I think about when I first ran, the only time I ran a half marathon, I am not a distance runner by any means. But I ran one just to see, hey, maybe this is fun. People get that runner's high. It never happened, but maybe it will someday. But one thing I taught myself while running, and I actually do this in most competition, is in my head, I say, check functionality. And by that, I mean, every now and then I'm running and I start to feel tired, right? Or my form starts getting weird. And what I do is I tell myself, check my functionality. Is there something that's preventing me from running correctly? Is my stride being affected from a pain? Is my hip not rotating correctly? Am I breathing correctly? If all the pieces work, then I'm just fatigued. Then I need to reset my form and keep going. No problem. If there is pain that is preventing something from functioning properly, right? Let's say I did injure, let's say my Achilles tendon is suddenly strained because I overtrained and I'm running, right? That pain is telling me there's something wrong. I'm going to re-injure it if I don't change my form. If I don't compensate for it, right? And that's an important thing that we do as athletes. We learn to read our bodies and understand when something is not working right, so that in the middle of a race, we know the difference between, okay, we're just tired mentally versus, oh no, we're actually hurting and we need to actually now adjust what we normally do. I can't keep going my full stride if there's something wrong, because I'm going to make it worse. And now I'm going to actually not finish the race as opposed to finish well. I wish that more athletes would take the time to do that on the mental side. Oftentimes we do focus, on the physical, and we do focus on the mental, but we focus more on mental strength of enduring, not necessarily the strength of confronting, the strength of opening up, and the strength of realizing that we don't have to succeed in order to succeed. You know what I mean? That's a weird way of saying, that basically, not competing, and in the Biles case, choosing to not compete for their mental health is just as important of a decision as choosing to endure when you think you can no longer go on. Knowing where that line is and understanding that this is important to your health, not just your physical health, but your mental health, which is just as equal in competition, especially with what they do. We run, okay, we're not going to get too hurt if we stop unless we trip and do something severe. In cycling, if I'm racing, I always have the option to slow down and let the pace go, you know, let the pack go, mm-hmm. and pull myself. In gymnastics, if you're going full out on a tumble pass and you're not mentally there, that one landing can end your career. It can end your life. You know, it's if you land wrong, you're talking about severe injury, if not death. I mean, that's the, mm-hmm. the level that they compete at, with the amount of force and the amount of, you know, movement that their body is going through. So all that's to say that I applaud her because of that, because of the willingness to put her mental aspect ahead of the game and say, this is just as important as anything I do physically. And in fact, will not only save me so that I can keep performing at my best, but mm-hmm. save my team as well, allow them to compete and allow them the chance to win. So mm-hmm. yeah, that's almost harder than I think than pushing through. And if you saw, I'm not sure if you saw the Ironman finish of the men's.
I didn't get to see that.
It was absolutely incredible. He pulled away from two people who were significantly younger than him. I want to say he was in his 30s, and the second place was at least 10 or plus years younger. Mm-hmm. And he dropped them in the last mile. And you see that when he crossed that finish line, he was devastated from a physical standpoint, even though he's emotionally elated, uh-huh. fell down on the ground, obviously, as rightfully he should, won the gold. Yeah. but the mental ability to push himself and tear himself away from who everyone called the odds-on favorite and the strongest runner in the field, and to drop him like that, you know, mm-hmm. he would have to tell his mind to go beyond anything his body thought it can do. And that's an incredible feat. But telling yourself you shouldn't do it, telling yourself you should stop when something is wrong, that is something that I think a lot of, especially elite athletes, are missing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things I deal with is I'm actually allergic to heat. It's a weird thing.
Oh my. Okay.
I just heard somebody
have, was on a podcast that has had a similar thing.
Yep. So and it doesn't matter whether I'm training outdoors or indoors. Once my body temperature gets elevated, my body will start to swell. It starts getting textured, kind of hives. But I race, you know, in Tulsa, and, you know, 96 degree heat, 110 humidity.
Mm-hmm, yeah. It gets hot in Tulsa.
I've had times where I've been in a race and I've had to say no. And I've had to pull myself from that race because it was getting too hot. I remember particularly one time, it was 2015 state championship road race. I was two laps into a four lap race. We were on the third lap, just started, about a quarter way in. And I was up front in the top 10, feeling great the whole time, but the heat was already in the high 90s and it was getting to me. I didn't realize it was mm-hmm. getting to me. Mm-hmm. I said, let me back up and just relax in the end of the pack. And then all of a sudden I see that that straight line on the side of the road is no longer straight, even though in my head I know it's straight, but it looks squiggly. Mm-hmm. I was beyond heat exhaustion at that point. And I pulled myself. Mm-hmm. And that was devastating because my body was in such good shape, but I had to deal with this limitation that I'm like, well, yeah, I could stay in there, possibly survive for another lap and a half, or I can pull myself, keep the rest of the field safe, and not die.
Right.
Because, you know, you really can. I had another race in Oklahoma City, the pro-am that they used to run there. Afternoon race, 2 p.m., hottest time of the day. And same thing. I was getting hot in the middle of the field, and this is a criterium. You know, we're doing 30 miles an hour around corners within inches of each other. And I knew that I was going to put myself and the field in danger. So I pulled myself halfway through that race, a good, you know, 25 minutes in. Unfortunately, there, to show how dangerous it is to push yourself and then not realize where you're pushing yourself, I remember exiting the course. I do not remember from the time I exited the course how I got into a chair at the tent with towels on me and the 45 minutes in between. It's gone from my mind.
Wow.
So, and I, you know, and there's a good, I don't know, third of a block, I had to have walked from where I got off the course to actually get back to the tent, put up my bike, you know, sit and so don't remember any of it. It's gone. Wow. So that just shows, you know, how far I was pushing myself. Mm-hmm. And it, for me, in one aspect, it's devastating because I love pushing myself. I love trying to achieve more. But I had to learn from the physical standpoint because of this limitation that I just have. I can't go that far without endangering my life or others. Mm-hmm. And on the mental side of things, it's kind of the same thing. You know, I've been in positions where I've been really stressed. I'm at a low, and, you know, in a depressive moment, and I've had to pull myself from competition because I'm worried about injuring myself. I mean, I'm carrying a 5-pound sword, mm-hmm. swinging it around with massive force. If it slips out of my hand, it can do a lot of damage to anyone nearby. Right. It never has, thankfully, but at the same time, you know, at some points we just have to know that it's okay to not be okay. I think that's mm-hmm. really what it comes down to.
So do you have any, like, is there a natural rhythm? I mean, there are certain times where that you know that you're more, there's more of a, susceptibility to those mental, the mental side of things.
There are, but it took a long time to learn that. And I didn't learn it on my own. The way I deal with it is my family and my friends. And it took a long time for me to be very forward about dealing with, you know, manic depression, being, you know, going manic, being hyper, being uncontrolled, being depressed and having the oscillations in between. But I now use my story, and I'll tell anyone, even on Facebook or, you know, social platforms, I'm like, if anyone's having a problem, use me, ask me questions, I will tell you everything I can about what I've been through so that you can learn your own coping mechanisms. So oftentimes, for example, if I'm going down or I'm heading toward a low, my behavior, my verbiage, the way I speak, the way I act will start to change. And my motivations will start to change. And my wife and my two daughters, they will let me know. They'll say, "Hey, are you you doing all right? You know, you didn't want to go on a ride today, and it was only 70 degrees, and it's been, you know, in the 90s. So that seems odd." And they'll tell me, and I want them to tell me, because then I'll look back over a couple of days, because usually, you know, you don't feel these things coming on; they happen so naturally, especially since I've had it all my life. I'll look back over a few days of my behavior and I'll say, I skipped that workout, or I cut that one short and I really didn't want to ride today. Something's up. Or, you know, I didn't quite feel like eating, or I didn't feel like, you know, talking on the phone to this person or that person. Little things, little cues. But it really is important that you have that network of people who you can be open with, who can see you and know what is normal for you, what is out of range. I tend to be hyper anyway, so it's kind of hard to know when I'm manic. Obviously, if I'm doing running, martial arts, cycling, sometimes all in one day, you know, I tend to have a lot of energy. So seeing when I'm on the manic side is a little more difficult for my family, but they can still tell, because the way I talk, the way I act will change. And so they kind of help me through it. It's not something I can really stop or put off. I used to try when I was younger, not realizing what I was actually doing. You know, try like we said before, you compartmentalize, you try to hide it. And now I try to understand it and understand, comprehend that this is happening. I'm not necessarily going to be able to get out of it. You know, this is just, it's biochemical. It's going to happen. But I can face it. I can understand and work with it. And that allows me to know that it's, you know, I like the phrase, the old Persian phrase, "This too shall pass," right? I know how I am, I know how I'm going to be, and I know how I'm going to be again, because it eventually does pass. Even at my lowest points, I know that I have been otherwise. Not that I want to, you know, and it's not a switch. People say, "Oh, smile." Oh, yeah, that's not how it works.
right.
So,
well, and it's like, I think from some of the things that I've learned is that that trying to resist those things actually makes them stronger.
Exactly right.
And so the willingness to walk through it is really what that's your coping mechanism is being willing to walk through it.
I think of it like when you're in a dark pool and you don't know which way is up, sometimes you have to stop struggling so your feet can hit the ground. That's the only way you're going to know which way is up, right?
Right.
Understand, you know, and that's the dark, you know, I like using that dark pool concept because you can't see, you know, you don't necessarily see a way out. You don't know how to get back to the surface where you normally are. But, and I'm not saying give in, you know, you want to get out of it, but you need to orient yourself. You need to understand you are in that pool, that that is not everything about who you are. And that your better self is still there. And you, if you can orient yourself and ground yourself into who you are, then eventually you're going to come right back up. It will happen. It, you know, sometimes that doesn't happen on its own. Sometimes we have to do medication. That's okay. You know, you need to find what mechanisms help. Cycling, martial arts, running, those help me.
That was what I was gonna ask. Did the athletic things that you do, does that help you even out a little bit?
They do for sure. And it's kind of hard because one thing I learned was that I was overcompensating. when you're very competitive, especially, and this is going back to the elite levels, right? When you are injured mentally, you can use competition and athletics to compensate, to level out your mind, to focus your body and your mind on something positive. The issue is that it can also, if you've been abused mentally or physically, it can also be turned into self-abuse. So at times I found I was using running and cycling and martial arts and I'm pushing so hard that I was injuring myself. And that became a sort of form of self-abuse. And this was before I was diagnosed and understood what I was really doing. But once I understood and I can level it out, that's where the balance came. That's where I need to do those runs and rides and I need to focus on my forms so I can clear my head, get myself out of that day space. And yeah, it's definitely, I mean, without working out, without training, there's no way I would be here today. I could say, honestly.
Okay. So you talk about that the pushing yourself becomes abusive.
Oh yeah.
As you were talking, I was thinking about all the ultra marathon runners at mile 80. and we're asking ourselves, why did we do this after all?
And that's it's a good point because, you know, the difference there, I would think, because I look at ultra marathoners and ultra runners. And for example, there was a team Suicide Prevention recently rode the race across America, 3,100 miles, you know, from San Diego to Maryland. I mean, that's just incredible.
And they're doing it in long days. I mean, they're doing it like an ultra marathon. They're not sleeping a lot. And
exactly right. So, you know, to push yourself to that degree, one is to do it, the mindset that you have behind it, you know, ultra marathon mindset, the mindset you have behind it is critical. Because if you do it for positive good, right, to improve on who you believe you can be and on what you could achieve, that's a good thing. If you do it to avoid other parts of your life, if you do it to focus on that pain rather than other pain that you already have inside, or if you're creating physical pain so you can avoid mental pain, that's where it becomes self-abusive. That's the dangerous part, because athletes, you know, we love to push ourselves. I mean, ultramarathoners are definitely up there. Cyclists, right? They'll go out and they continue to push, bigger numbers, faster, longer, right? And it can become a really dangerous cycle. Strava has not helped this by any means.
Oh yes, I know. I mean, there are people who you know, they go after those Strava. And I think from what I see, just from the work that I do, is that there are some runners, and it's not just runners, it's just life. We tend to build our identity, who we are, on what we can do or what we have done.
Right.
And so those people who are competing for the Strava King of the Mountain and, you know, the Strava winning the segments, it can be unhealthy because you know, that the competition can drive you to be your best, but it can also, you know, be your greatest enemy.
It can drive you to be your worst.
Yeah. And I was thinking about a lady that I spoke with on the podcast here. She doesn't run races because her competitive edge is so great that she says that she needs to just run for fun.
Yeah.
Because she is so competitive that it's like she knows that about herself, and she's says, I don't put myself in that position because it's not good for me.
Well, that goes back to the point I was saying, is understanding that when to say no, understanding when to say, I got to stop, right? Is just as important as learning from an athletic perspective of saying, no, I have to keep going. I can push harder. I can go longer. Understanding when to stop, though, is not really what we're taught from a young age, especially in athletics. Right. We're taught to be better.
Winners never quit. Never quit.
You know, winners never quit. And the one that absolutely makes my blood boil is, you win or you learn, you never lose. I'm like, oh, what? No.
Yeah.
If you don't admit you lost, what have you learned? You know, I try to teach my girls who my older daughter, she's 16. She competes in Wushu as well. My younger one just joined swim team. And, I've tried to teach them as they're rather competitive like I am. But I've always tried to teach them that it's okay to lose, because losing and acknowledging the loss, especially acknowledging the loss, lets you know that you are not where you believe you could be. You have been beaten by someone who has been better prepared, or you have been beaten by, let's say, yourself. You are not better prepared. You have an off day. It's okay, but it gives you a chance to reflect on the reasons you did not win, the reasons why someone else beat you. But if we don't acknowledge that loss, and we just say, "Oh, well, I can, you know, I was beaten," or you know, "Oh, I can do better," but not, you know, exactly examine why we did those things, there could be a whole bunch of stuff we're missing in order to get better. In fact, part of teaching martial arts, I found, is as you teach, you need to understand what you don't know, in order to understand how to teach it to someone else. You'll quickly learn when you try to teach someone anything, when it comes to running form, when it comes to how to handle a corner in a criterium, how to, do a particular stance from martial arts. If you don't know how to explain it properly, then obviously something is missing in your own knowledge. So it's really important to know that and learn what we are missing. But unfortunately, our culture doesn't really push that. My monitor just turned on in the background there.
Oh, yeah, that's that's fine.
So we don't really teach that from a young age in sports. We typically focus on the winning aspect and the getting better aspect, but we don't necessarily focus on the limiting aspect, on when we know when we should stop and evaluate and say, we have now gone into dangerous territory. A lot of kids, especially in contact sports, and I love contact sports, so I'm not getting on them, but they don't understand the damage that their body can do or how to read it, because they're young. And they're, you know, especially at the non-Olympic levels, you know, when you have someone like Simone Biles, who has so many coaches and doctors and teachers around them, they can read those signals and help them understand their body and when things are not working right. Most of us are unfortunately not privy to that information or access to those types of coaches. So we end up at a young age pushing ourselves too hard, injuring ourselves, going too fast. And we learn that lesson of always get bigger, better, stronger. The word epic, right?
Right.
And in one way, it's great. Always strive, always push to be better. But not at the point, not to the degree that it ultimately damages yourself or who you are or who you could be even. So there has to be a balance in there. And I firmly believe in the golden mean, in the middle path, in that the extreme of anything is wrong. Too much rest is wrong. Too much training is wrong. Too much food is wrong. Too much lack of food is wrong.
Right.
We need to find a balance in all things. That includes positive and negative. There are goods, there are positives to have out of negatives, right? It's okay to lose. It's okay to not do your best and learn from those situations. And it's okay to say, enough, I need to step back, regardless of what the world thinks of me.
How do you, in martial arts, I would imagine there that you have developed some amount of awareness and connection to your body, probably more. Yeah. Probably more so than the average athlete, just because of that kind of form focus. Say for your average athlete, what are some of the things that they could do to maybe tap into that type of awareness? Because I think a lot of regular, people, unless we've concentrated on it, have a tendency to, our mind is over here and our body's over here, and the mind is, we think, mind over matter,
right?
That we can, our mind is, and our mind ends up being this severe drill sergeant.
Oh, yeah.
To push the body. And so there's not a lot of connection between the two. I mean, as far as feedback and back and forth. So, and if you have, could speak to your experience in kind of, linked to, the challenges that you've faced to be able to have that better connection between your mind and your body.
So one thing right off the top of my head that I can think of is if you are a one sport person, try a different sport. And I don't mean that in like, okay, go out and buy, a $6,000 race bike and get in and jump into racing. By all means.
Oh my goodness. I had that on my list.
To try something different, because of two reasons. One, our mind gets trained into doing things very efficiently in what we do. Whatever we do, our body and mind are efficiency engines. Figure out the lowest state of energy and the lowest amount of energy we can use to do it. Mm-hmm. That means that we tend to get really good at doing that one thing and not realizing that without doing other things, we're not supporting it. It's like building a Jenga tower, right? You can put brick on top of brick on top of brick. Eventually you get really good at that one thing. But if the littlest thing goes wrong, right, that tower falls because you haven't built up those ancillary systems. So cross training is really important because it allows us to realize where those deficiencies lie, not only in how we normally push ourselves mentally, but in our physical bodies as well. We can feel, oh, wow, you know what? I've been riding a bike. My legs go over really, really well. But you know what? They're kind of spindly. And and even, or they might be big this way, but my lateral movement is horrible. Every time I step sideways, my hip hurts, even though I can hammer all day on the bike. You tend to learn very quickly by doing other things where your deficiencies lie. When you get into, if you try ice skating, if you try like, I also do speed skating. I started recently, which is really, really fun. Speed skating on the road.
Speed skating.
Yeah.
Oh, speed skating. Okay.
So
with inline skates?
It's like inline skates, but they're bigger wheels, longer frame, no brakes.
Okay. No brakes. How do you stop?
Find a
soft patch of grass to jump into.
That too, usually. Yeah. doing these different sports basically shows me where, and yeah, I know I'm not going to get great at all of them. That's really not my goal. My goal is to figure out where the deficiencies lie in my training. Even just, if you're a runner and you skip out on doing any weight training, just starting to do lightweight training. If you are a cyclist and you don't like stretching, hey, maybe it's time to try and learn how to stretch. In fact, I advocate that for everyone. Stretching is an amazing thing. anyway, but that would be my first thing that comes to mind, is try a different sport to move outside of your mental comfort zone. Not necessarily get great at it, but to understand where your body has been designed to be efficient and where you're lacking, to give yourself more perspective. The next thing I would say for to answer your question there is understand when you're training, try to get an outside perspective. We tend to isolate ourselves in our training, in our numbers, especially when we're not proud of our numbers when we're just starting, right? We tend to compare ourselves only to the highest in the game. So we have kind of a duality of a problem. One is we don't want others to really know when we're suffering. We just want to do great all the time. Two, the other problem is we compare ourselves only to the people doing the best and not to what we're doing. And so gaining a little objectivity and outside perspective, talking to other athletes, other runners, of all different levels, not just the top, will allow you to see what their struggles were, allow you to see how things are either mentally or physically stopping them from performing at their best, what they went through. That's where forming communities, forming networks, teams of cyclists are the better teams, are good at this, are good at communicating with each other to understand where they're deficient and how to learn from one another. And it helps you, again, it's about grounding, about figuring out how to not push yourself too far, how to push yourself enough so you can push yourself harder, right? I like to say, don't win the one race and give up on all future races. Because it's just not worth it, right? You're gonna, you can tear yourself apart, and yeah, you won that race, but is that really, are you done? Do you really not want to do this ever again?
Well, for ultra marathon runners, what we say is you don't go out. I mean, you typically at the beginning of the race, if you go out too fast, you're really gonna pay for it, and that, it's natural to, everybody else is there, you're excited, it's a race, and it's natural to, those first several miles. And had a friend tell me, he says, you can't win a 100-mile race in the first 5 miles.
That's right.
But you can certainly lose it in the first five, in the first 5 miles. And that's kind of what you're talking about is learning how to pace yourself in life in the same kind of way, is know kind of where, what your body, your mind and body both, where your performance is.
Yeah.
And there's a term. And there's it's a balance.
Yeah. There's a term that they use, that coaches, especially on Trainer Road, the coaches there, use the term cognitive load. And it's basically to say how much is on your mind and occupying the space you need to do everything else. Right. Mm-hmm. If you're dealing with, taking care of your kids, doing work, taking care of the house, taking care of bills, taking care of, all that stress will affect how much you have left over to work on your athletic performance, right? There's only so much your mind can handle at one time. And so being cognizant of that cognitive load, understanding, okay, you know what? My mind is dealing with all this stuff. Maybe today I'm not going to try to run that 30 miler as a warm-up for my race next week. maybe I'm going to cut it down and take a little bit of that extra time and read a book, relax, play a game, take yourself out of training, which is a little weird because, people are like, wait a minute, we're training. We need to push, especially, ultra mindset, right?
I have a friend who I kind of understand her mindset, but she, if it's written down, I mean, she's got to do it. It kind of doesn't matter how she feels, if it's written down on the training plan, she's going to go out and do those miles. And I know that she's not alone. There are a lot of people who are that way. And that's kind of why they write training plans, but it becomes a, an obligation. This is brought down from the mountaintop by Moses. And we have to do this. For those kinds of people, if you're out and it's like today, in Kansas,
yeah,
heat index is supposed to be 115 degrees.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm going to go run later. But if you get out there and your body is saying, you know, this, it's too hot.
Right.
Stop. I mean, to have those, and that's kind of what you've been saying in a lot of those areas, mentally and physically, know when it's time to say, hey, this is not happening today.
Hit the brakes.
And I need to stop, and I need to go do something else. And, you know, and in general, you know, in a day, but, or of like, I need to read a book. I need to take some time off of training.
Yep. When I'm teaching Criterium basic skills, Criterium is a short form race course. So you're, think of it like a NASCAR on a bike. So you're doing a 1 mile loop, right? On sharp turns, high speed, and you're racing for a certain amount of time. It can be very dangerous, right? You're literally racing within inches of, you know, people all around you. And the first thing I tell anyone that I'm teaching when they're, you know, the beginners, I say, if you feel uncomfortable, you know, there's a quote from the movie Ronin. He says, when in doubt, there is no doubt. That's rule number one. And I still stick to that to this day. If you are uncomfortable, if something doesn't feel right, let it go. Let the field go. And that's it. You can still race behind them, keep going. And the same thing with training when you're running, right? I did that run up in Denver the other day. It was 86. We had rare humidity. Usually it's not humid up there, but they had a storm and it got humid. And then you had the lack of
oxygen. That is unusual.
Yeah, it is unusual. So yeah. I'm running and I'm like, you know, and I left the apartment thinking I'm going to hold about a 7:45 pace for 4 miles. Should be good. And that's pushing for me. But I thought, okay, I'm feeling good. Let me do that. And a mile in, I'm thinking there's no way. It's, you know, cause usually the humidity, if without humidity, I start doing well, even with the heat, but didn't matter. I said, there's something wrong. And that's when I said, you know, there's doubt, back it off. And my pace ended up being like, I don't know, 8:45, 8:50. I don't care. I was happy. I finished it. I still got through it,
yeah.
But I didn't have to beat myself up over it. And I was happy I finished. Yeah. I went out with one expectation, but I didn't have to stick to that. And that's something I think a lot of the, and I'm notorious for not sticking to training plans. So, you know, feel free to take my advice and throw it out the window.
Me too. I wrote one and it's, I haven't entered my times for the last 3 weeks.
Right. So, you know, I get that. But what I would say is, even if you have that training plan written down, learn to allow for life. I often say life gets in the way of living, right? We have these plans, we have these goals, we have this training plan. Sticking to it 100% of the time might give you a nice feeling like, look, I stuck with it. I did great. But you might end up paying for it in the end. Because if you did that super hot run, you know, long run on the day where you know your body just couldn't take it, you're going to end up hurting yourself later on. And by the time you get to that competition point, you might not be in as good of shape as you could have been had you just backed off a little bit, had you just cut that run down a little bit, right? So, and I think that's life, right? We tend to be very rigid about certain things and then other things we don't care about at all.
Right. Yeah. We let some of the things that we let go, we shouldn't.
Right. Exactly.
Things we push through is like, well, we shouldn't push through.
So I tend to believe heavily in flexibility, not just stretching, but mental flexibility and flexibility in life, being able to roll with the punches. And by that, I think in training as well, it's awesome to stick to the training plan. You want to train 4 times a week, you want to get these miles in and so on, but don't be so rigid that it ends up hurting yourself. And again, this goes both mentally and physically. If at work something happened, right, that was just horrible, your boss just tore you up and down, and you know, and it was unjustified, and you know that it was unfair, and you come home and you're supposed to go out and run your 10K or whatever, and your mind is just destroyed already. You're going to perform not at your top. So when you run that 10K, it's okay if you didn't keep the time you wanted. Like you could still do it. If you don't want to do it at all, that's fine. Find something enjoyable instead. But if you get joy out of running, don't beat yourself up if you don't make your time. Don't beat yourself up if you don't do that goal to that, you know, that distance. Allow for flexibility in training and life. And I think that's going to take some of that mental, that cognitive load off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for some of us who are runners, I mean, that cognitive load, running is a way that helps us to manage,
Sure.
It's a way to set that aside when you're, especially trail running, when you have trail running takes a lot of focus because there's stuff to trip over. But I mean, you know, it's like runners, their spouses or significant other will say to them, you know, you probably need to go for a run. You've been acting.
That's exactly right.
I can just tell just from living with you, you should go out for a run.
Yep.
I've heard that before, but you know, but those runs, I mean, those times, you know, like, I think what you're saying is appropriate. Those times are probably not the time to go out and try to set the Strava record.
Yep.
not on those days.
Leave the PR at home. We're good.
Yeah, leave the PR at home. Yeah. But, you know, some of those runs you just need for yourself.
Exactly.
And,
right.
And so, learning that balance is great. Well, thank you a lot. I try to keep these to about an hour, and we're right at an hour.
Awesome.
If somebody wanted to reach out to you, if they've heard, you know, kind of what you were talking about and said, hey, you know, I'd like to get a little bit more, How can they find you?
Well, they can reach me on Facebook at Marshall Cyclist. The same thing on Instagram at Marshall Cyclist. Felt exactly how it looks, no space, no nothing.
okay.
I'm on those, and yeah, I'm open to talk about anything, everything, martial arts, cycling, my horrible running form, you name it, I'll talk about it.
Well, you know, the horrible running form, as long as it gets you down the road, you know, without being injured, that's a win right there.
There you go.
Well, thank you. I will, I'll put those links in the show notes, for the show, and, I appreciate this. And it's a timely topic. I know that, and I think that there are more people out there that, that are in, you know, some area of that kind of feeling like they maybe have pushed those things aside.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that, you know, this story, this podcast, and what Simone has done will allow those people to kind of say, you know, hey, maybe this is something I should really think about and get out and get some help with.
Sure. I hope so.
So thank you a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And I'll look forward to seeing your adventures on Facebook.
I'll keep going.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of the Ultramarathon Mindset Trail Talk. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider giving us a 5-star rating and review. And don't forget to subscribe. That way you won't miss out on any new episodes. If you'd like to contact me, you can find me on Facebook as at Ultramarathon Mindset, or you can find me on the web at theultramarathonmindset.com. Remember, your mindset is the key to success in running and in life, and developing a strong mindset is a skill you can improve. Hey, thanks again for listening. I'll see you next time.